we're meeting in a different place every week. It's almost like we're on the run. We're the underground church, and we're trying to, you know, stay one step ahead of the KGB, man, from busting down the doors and arresting us. So I kind of like this. I think it's pretty cool. It shows us that we're adaptable. You know, there's the church isn't a building. It's where we meet. And who cares where that is, right? But really thankful for all the places that Ashley's finding for us to meet. And it's free. And we just love it. We just appreciate it. Last week, we discussed how the children share in flesh and blood. So therefore, he himself likewise also partook of the same. So Jesus taking on the very form of man, he had to. And we're going to talk about the why here in a second as well on the verses we're dealing with today. And it said that one of the purposes of why he did what he did was that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is the devil. See, the devil was using sin and death as his weapons for a long time. And Jesus decided, like one of David's mighty men, to go down into the pit, take his own spears and run him through with them. Habakkuk chapter 3 actually lays that out in pretty vivid detail. One of my favorite messianic prophecies. It's pretty cool. Go check it out. Where Habakkuk talks about how he lays him open from thigh to neck with his own spears. That's just cool. I mean, I don't know how many people appreciate, you know, a good gruesome analogy like that, war analogy. But when you have the ultimate enemy and he gets laid open from thigh to neck, I dig that. Right? And that's what Jesus did. He used his own weapons to destroy him. And then on the flip side, after he destroys the enemy, he frees those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. See, so that now Christians do not have to fear death. It is an enemy, but it's not something that needs to be feared, as in we would exchange everything that we have for one more moment, one more breath, one more day. For the Christian, that's not necessary. Now, it doesn't mean that we wouldn't be sad leaving here, especially, you know, on the stage of life, right? I mean, quite honestly, I was talking to somebody the other day, and I can't remember who it was, and they were talking about, you know, they've got young kids. And they were talking about still having a fear of death. And I said, look, I get that. And it's not because maybe necessarily you're afraid of dying. It's you need to be here for your children. I totally understand that. That's a very valid concept. But with the normal course of life, the way that it works is we eventually want to leave this place. We don't want to hang on to it with all that we have. I mean, the outer man is decaying. The inner man is being renewed day by day. And what happens is the desire to be here versus the desire to be there starts to shift and starts to switch and starts to change. And it gets placed on its head to where we now want to leave here and we want to go there. Now, Paul was there probably faster than most people. He said, I would much rather be absent from the body and present with the Lord. But then again, one of the places he said that was in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. And one of the reasons he did that, you might want to check out 2 Corinthians chapter 1. All the suffering that he had, the sentence of death, and then read 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and see all the things that he went through, all of the things that he was still suffering from. I mean, I'm going to cut Paul a lot of slack where after all the things that he did, all the things that he suffered for the church, yeah. But you know what he said? He said another place, I believe it was Philippians, to stay on is more profitable for you. So that's what I'm going to do. That's what I want to do. Now, ultimately, he didn't have control over that. God did. But even though he really wanted to go on to his reward, he recognized that his work wasn't done. And when he did, read 2 Timothy, when he did recognize his work was done, he was ready to go. He did not want to stay any longer. That's what happens when we're delivered from a fear of death. That's what happens when that slavery has been liberated. We have the freedom to be bold in our faith because it doesn't matter what happens to us to a certain extent. And we also trust the Lord that he's going to take care of those we leave behind. So now we're going to move on to the next passage, starting in verse 16. He says, "For surely he does not give help to angels, but he gives help to the descendant of Abraham. Therefore, he had to be made like his brethren in all things, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, and to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For since he himself was tempted in all that he has suffered, all which he has suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted." Now, as I was studying this out, I actually came to realize that I was misunderstanding verse 16. And the reason I was misunderstanding verse 16 is because I relied on the New American Standard translation without taking a look at it in its context. He says, "For surely he does not give help to angels, but he gives help to the descendant of Abraham." Now, they purposely translate that descendant, and so that always made me think that he's talking about Christ. And so the he who gives help is God, and the one he's not giving help to is the angels, but the one he is giving help to is Christ. That's how I've always understood that. But then as I was studying this out, I started to think a little bit and, you know, bounce some ideas off of some different places. And I recognized that I was reading that wrong. Yes, the word for descendant there is the singular word for seed, which is used constantly in the New Testament. Sometimes it refers, even though it's singular, sometimes it's referring to plural. Sometimes it's referring to singular. And we'll look at some verses up that show that, even in Hebrews, actually. So I was thinking, I need to follow the pronouns. You follow the pronouns, the verse makes a lot more sense. So the question you have to ask yourself is, in verse 16, "For assuredly he does not give help to angels, but he gives help to the descendant of Abraham." The question is, who's the he? Well, guess what? It's the same he that's found in verse 14. "Therefore, since the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise also partook of the same, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and might free those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. For surely he does not give help to angels, but he gives help to the son of Abraham. Therefore, he had to be made like his brethren in all things." It's the same he all the way through there, isn't it? There's no change of the antecedent to the pronoun. So the he there is Christ. He gives help to the descendant of Abraham. And I want to show you that I think that that should be descendants of Abraham, as in Abraham's children of faith. Okay, so let's look at a few verses here. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 11. I like this one because it's the same author. It's the same author. Hebrews chapter 11, and let's look at verse 18. Well, 17. It says, "By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. And it was he to whom it shall be said, 'In Isaac your descendants shall be called.'" So, in Isaac your descendants shall be called. So, that word for descendants there is singular seed. "In Isaac your seed shall be called." So, someone might say, well, that still could be referring to Christ, because in Galatians chapter 3, he says, "Into your seed, that is Christ." So, maybe that's what he's talking about there. Well, this passage is also quoted in Romans chapter 9. So let's see how Paul uses it there. Let's go to Romans chapter 9. Keep your finger there in Hebrews 11. We're going to be back there. Let's go to verse 6. Verse 6. "But it's not as though the word of God has failed. For they are not all Israel who are descended from Israel, nor are they children because they are Abraham's descendants. But through Isaac your descendants will be named." That is, it's not the children of the flesh who are children of God, but the children of the promise who are regarded as descendants. See, same verse, definitely meaning plural. That's definitely not meaning singular. He's talking about plural descendants there. So it's the same verse, and Paul definitely has connotation or a presence in the book of Hebrews. There's debate on that, but the theology and the grammar, the words that are used are definitely, not the grammar, but the words that are used are definitely Paul. The grammar is more Luke, and so that kind of makes sense. This passage is definitely referring to seeds. Now, let's go back to Hebrews 11. Let's look at verse 11. So we're going to talk about Sarah for a second. Hebrews 11:11. It says, by faith, even Sarah herself conceived or received ability to conceive even beyond the proper time of life. Since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, there was born even to one man to him as good as dead. At that, as many descendants as the stars of the heaven in number and innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. So in there, New American Standard doesn't do well. But in verse 11, where it says New American Standard ability to conceive, it really means the power for the laying down of seed. And that word for seed is singular. So you would think, okay, well, Isaac is her descendant, so singular seed, that makes sense. But notice the connection that the writer of Hebrews is making. The writer of Hebrews is saying in verse 12, therefore there was born even to one man, and to him as good as dead, at that as many descendants as the stars of the heaven in number, and innumerable as the sand which is on the seashore, or by the seashore. So he's making the point there that it's plural. That, and that's how the word seed should be interpreted. Now, it's found also many other times like that as well. I won't necessarily go into it, but if you want to look them up, Romans chapter 4, verses 13 and 16, talking about Abraham and definitely using the singular word seed and it's plural. John chapter 8, verse 33, Acts 13:23. All of these are singular usages of seed, but they should be plural. So when you think about the Galatians 3 passage, and I know we're, I'm not trying to wrangle over words here. I'm just trying to lay out something that's going to make sense here in a second. In the Galatians 3 passage where Paul does make the point where he says, into seed, not to seeds as in many, but one that is Christ. Paul's actually making the point that the reading should be singular instead of plural. So what he's letting us know is that that's not the normal reading of the text. He's drawing attention that it should be singular in that context. But in other contexts, Paul does use it in a plural way, even though the noun is singular. Now, back to Hebrews chapter 2, and I'll show you why this is important. Because when I understood that it was Christ receiving the help from God, I never thought that the verse made actual sense in the context. It's like, what? Why is he talking about help given to Christ? Not to angels, but to Christ. He's talking about Christ giving help to the children of Abraham. And if you think about it, beforehand, wasn't that help that he gave them? Freeing those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives? That sounds like help, doesn't it? Does he need to give that help to angels? No, they weren't subject to slavery through fear of death, were they? Not at all. Now look at verse 17. Therefore, he had to be made like his brethren in all things, so that he might become the merciful and faithful high priest of things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For since he himself was tempted in that which he has suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. Verses 17 and 18 are all about the help that he gives to the seed of Abraham, the children of Abraham, you and I. That's the help. Laying it out very specifically. So now that passage actually flows really well with the context before it and the context after it. So now I want to break down verses 17 and 18 here a little bit to lay this out. So where it says he had to, there in 17, the word there means he was obligated to. He had an actual obligation to be made like the brethren in all things. why in the world would Jesus have an obligation to be made like us in all things? And that concept for all things, guess what? That means all things. In every single respect. In other words, there's not a respect in which Jesus was not made like us. Now, let's think about all the different theologies that are out there, shall we? The one that dominates the landscape among all different types of parts of Christianity, well, what calls itself Christianity, is the doctrine of original sin and total depravity. On some level, it's all over the place. If you go to just about any type of church that's out there, including some restoration movement churches, Christian churches, churches of Christ, they will say that we are born depraved or we are born physically with a sinful nature. The Bible does not state that. And so the bottom line is that if we're born with a sinful nature, if Jesus was made like us in all things, Jesus was born with a sinful nature. He was born with original sin. Whoa, we know that's not true. That's not true at all. If he was born like that, if he was born somehow tainted, he could not have been the sacrifice. And so they understand this, and so they recognize that Jesus was different. And so the example that they come up with on how Jesus was different is that he wasn't born from the typical union that creates children. Because even in marriage, this goes back to Augustine, even in marriage, the physical relationship between husband and wife that creates children is evil. It's sinful. Now, I won't go into all the details because you might think, well, what about Adam and Eve? They were told to be fruitful and multiply in perfection. They've got an explanation for that too, and it's weird. And I won't get into it, especially since it's more of a PG-13 type of discussion. Okay? But it's, if you want to talk about it, we can. It's, you know, catch up with me later. I've done a lot of study on it. It's just weird. All right. Augustine was not right in the head. One of the first things that he wrote was a book called Confessions. I wouldn't even be able to read to you many of the sections of that book in mixed company. He was not right. And so when he became a Christian, quote unquote, he brought in his mindset about those things into the church, and he became celibate. And he insisted that everybody, even married people, should be celibate except if they're trying to have kids. Because it's all wicked, every bit of it. Now, he brought that in from Gnosticism, because he was a Gnostic. That's where that came from. So I find it very interesting that the primary doctrine that undergirds most of Christianity, what calls itself Christianity, is actually a foundational tenet of Gnosticism. It's a horrible thing. Jesus was made like his brethren in all things, which means if Jesus wasn't born with a sinful nature, if Jesus wasn't born with original sin, neither were you. You are born with a blank slate, neutral, but you're born into a world of sin. So that world of sin is going to have an impact on children right from the get-go because they're sponges. They soak this stuff up. So that's one of the reasons why when they reach an age of accountability, they fall. They choose to sin because they're surrounded by it. But I want you to understand the power of the incarnation of Christ and the power of his purity. Jesus was born into the same world. He was born with the same neutral blank slate that every other human being is born with. And yet from his earliest instances, he chose to follow his father. The first instance we see of him making a decision is when he's 12 years old. And he already has that concept, doesn't he? I had to be in my Father's house. That's what he had to do. That's where he had to be. Why? He had to. He was obligated to be made like his brethren in all things. So that, notice what he says next, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God. See, the way Jesus operated is that in order for him to actually be the merciful and faithful high priest in the things pertaining to God, his priestly duties, he had to be made like us in all things. If he wasn't made like us in all things, he couldn't be the high priest. That's why it's so dangerous to say that Jesus was different than humanity. Because if Jesus was different from humanity, then he couldn't become the merciful and faithful high priest. Think about it. If you're born with a sinful nature, with a dirty slate already, and Jesus isn't, and he's somehow immune to all of these things, how in the world can he relate to you? How can he do what verse 18 states? For since he himself was tempted in that which he has suffered, he's able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. He has no idea what I'm experiencing if he doesn't have the same pull that we have in sin. No idea. So Jesus and us were made exactly the same. It makes his ability and his choices to overcome sin and not give in to temptation even one time even more powerful, even more worthy of awe, and more worthy of respect, so that when we get into the depths of things that we don't quite understand, when we get in way over our head with things, we don't have to be scared because somebody's already tread that path before and he's told us he will never leave us nor forsake us. He is always there to help us. And I've been where you're at and I know how to do it. Just follow me. Rely on my help. Rely on my power that I'm giving you. Rely on my expertise and I'll be able to help you through. Now, not only is his ability to be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God dependent upon him becoming like us in all things, so is this next part. To make propitiation for the sins of the people. Now, that's interesting. That word propitiation is a very misunderstood word. A lot of people, and what I was taught, was that the word propitiation means a covering. So the way that somebody explained it in Bible college one time, and I might have used the story before, but forgive me if it's actually better here than maybe when I used it. He wrote a bunch of sins on the whiteboard in red. And then he handed out glasses that were red. So we all put these glasses on that were red, and guess what? All the red lettering disappeared. He said, now take off the glasses. We took off the glasses to see the sin is there. See, when you come into Christ, Christ's blood covers the sin. God's looking through blood-colored glasses. That might sound familiar. Blood-colored glasses, and he can't see the sin, even though the sin is still there. And if the blood is ever removed, all that sin is still there, and God will hold you accountable for it. Now, the reason that's so wrong is that is exactly what the Old Testament sacrifices did. The Old Testament sacrifices were the blood-covered glasses that God used to not hold people accountable for the sins that were still there. The word propitiation comes from a root word meaning to satisfy. So what's actually taking place here is not a covering of sin that's still there, but a satisfaction of those sins, an actual removal of those sins. That's what's taking place. So that when we come into Christ, they're not still there. They're actually gone. God doesn't need to look at us through blood-colored glasses because as the book of Revelation states, let's go to Revelation chapter 7 for a second. He talks about the multitude that came out of the tribulation. Let's look at verse 13, Revelation 7, 13. He says, "Then one of the elders answered, saying to me, 'These are these who are clothed in white robes. Who are they, and where have they come from?' I said to him, 'My Lord, you know.' And he said to me, 'These are the ones who have come out of the great tribulation,'" and look at this, "'and they have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. For this reason, they are before the throne of God, and they serve him night, day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will spread his tabernacle over them.'" Does it say they've covered over their sins with the blood? No, they've made their robes white with blood. See, normally, especially all of us who have had children, which I think all of us in here have, well, almost all of us, soon, you'll figure it out. Blood is one of the harder things to get out of clothing. You don't put blood on clothing to get it clean. Blood stains. It just does. How do you get white out of blood? Pure white. That's how God operates. We're talking spiritual detergent. The blood of Christ actually washes us clean. It doesn't cover over filth so that it's still there. Wouldn't that make us whitewashed tombs? Full of dead men's bones, but look good on the outside? God's not imparting life. God's not imparting the Spirit into someone who still has sins that he's just pretending isn't there anymore. They have to be removed. And to say that the blood of Christ doesn't remove sin, it just covers it, blasphemes the blood of the covenant. It actually removes the sin. If God wanted to simply cover it over, we would have stayed under the Old Testament sacrifices, because that's exactly what they did. Jesus made propitiation. He covered, he satisfied, he removed, he got rid of the sin. He didn't just cover it. What's that based on? That's based on him being a merciful and faithful high priest, which is based upon him being made like his brethren in all things. You remove any one of those steps in the chain. And the way that that chain is listed, the grammar that's in there shows that these are all purpose clauses. In other words, they're dependent upon the clause before them. Which means you remove one piece, the whole thing falls apart. And typically the piece that gets removed is Jesus being made like us in all things. It destroys everything. You want to know the last thing he does to give help? And this gets destroyed if he wasn't like us. And we've already talked about it, so I'm not going to dive too deep into it. Verse 18. "Since he himself was tempted in that which he was suffered, he's able to come to the aid of those who are tempted." One thing I will bring out, that word for suffered there is a perfect tense verb, which means it happened in the past and the consequences are still here now. You know what he's talking about there? The suffering of Christ may have happened in the past, but what he learned and what he is now able to do extends now into the future. We suffer when we're tempted. We don't suffer when we give in to temptation. We suffer when we resist temptation. Jesus knows that very well. So because he suffered when he resisted temptation, he's able to come to the aid of those who are being tempted. That's you. That's me. Those lessons he learned by being made like us in all things, he is now able to give to us, to encourage us and to help us move through those things. He does it through the Scripture. He does it through his Spirit. He does it through our fellowship with one another. You know, the Lord's Supper, all of these things that God has given us are designed to encourage us, are designed to strengthen us. That's why, you know, things like what we did yesterday. That is just as important as when we come together to assemble. It's just as important to have those fellowships as it is for us to open up the scripture. Because I don't know about you, I had some amazing conversations yesterday. I was encouraged by things that people said to me, and hopefully I was able to encourage others. Hearing what people are going through, hearing what people are suffering, being able to pray for them, being able to help them, being able to offer scriptural counsel, all of these things and things that I receive, they're absolutely essential. Partaking of the Lord's Supper, singing praises, having fellowship in the Word, all of these things are designed by God to give us help, to give us aid. Because when we do this right, we don't just say, Jesus was up here, we're down here. You know, essentially, I know he's an example, but we can't really go to him because he just had it better. We're just stuck down here trying to trot along the best that we can. You know, we keep falling flat on our face, and we're just going to keep falling flat on our face. You know, I guess just don't stay in the mud too long. No. We all encourage each other with the example of Christ. That's what we do, so that we know we're not alone. You know, I've heard it said before that, you know, where his hands, where his feet, where his eyes, where his ears. And I think that's really true. You know, he uses us along with the scripture, along with the Spirit, but he uses us to get a lot of the work done. And I'm really appreciative of that. I'm appreciative of the saints here. I'm really appreciative of the saints all over. Because what we're able to do for each other is really important. So let's just keep on excelling still more, recognizing that we're one of the primary ways that Jesus is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted, along with his own personal example, his own personal scriptures, his Spirit bearing witness with our spirit, pushing us forward. So hopefully that's an encouragement, but anybody got any questions or comments on that before we close up? No? Okay. Hey, Dakota, you want to close us out with a word of prayer, brother?